All right, we were talking in our last segment about some nostalgia from old articles from the San Francisco Chronicle. We're also talking about travel. And there's a perfect convergence between those two items in another edition of The Wayback Machine by Johnny Miller, which we are going to talk about. In this case, the paper was looking back to May of 1942. And notes that Chronicle reporter Stanton Delaplane yesterday was awarded the 1941 Pulitzer Prize. The $500 award went to Delaplane for his coverage of the story of five Northern California counties, which threatened to secede and form the 49th state of Jefferson, which this really gave me pause. There's been all this talk of late about the state of Jefferson up in Northern California. I did not realize it goes back to the 1940s and perhaps beyond. Did you know that? Dear listener. At any rate, the piece goes on to say that Delaplane is the second Chronicle staff member to win the Pulitzer Award. Royce Breyer, Chronicle columnist, received it in 1934 for his coverage of the San Jose lynchings of 1933. And you know, I remember my grandfather describing that episode to me when I was a boy. It was quite a horrible episode. And, doing a little refresher course here using the internet, in this case a Wikipedia article about the case. And I would like to take a moment to digress and discuss what I found. The case surrounded the murder of Brooke Hart, the eldest son of Alexander Hart, the owner of Leopold Hart & Son Department Store on Santa Clara Street in downtown San Jose. Reportedly, Hart had worked in his family's department store during much of his youth and was well known and liked by the local community. After he graduated from Santa Clara University, his father made him junior vice president in their store and began grooming him to take over when he retired. On November 9th, 1933, the 22-year-old Hart was kidnapped while retrieving his 1933 Studebaker Roadster, a graduation present from his parents from a downtown San Jose garage. According to later confessions, two men had plotted to kidnap Hart, John Holmes and Thomas Thurmond. The kidnappers transferred Hart to another car, then drove him out to the San Mateo Bridge. Hart was ordered out of the car, and one of the kidnappers struck him twice in the head from behind with a concrete block until he was unconscious. The kidnappers bound his arms with baling wire before dumping him into the bay. The tide was out, and there was only a few feet of water at the base of the bridge, so the kidnappers shot him, killing him. A few hours later, they placed a telephone call to the Hart family demanding $40,000 for Hart's return, with further instructions to follow. Not to belabor this case too much, but it turns out that the kidnappers were captured while making ransom demands from a payphone. Their confessions and descriptions of what they did to Hart were later corroborated when his body turned up. Authorities had been expecting trouble if and when the missing body was found, and after the discovery of Hart's body, it's reported on Wikipedia that all day Sunday and into the evening, all day that day and into the evening, radio stations issued inflammatory announcements that a lynching would occur that night at St. James Park in San Jose. Governor James Sonny Jim Rolfe made comments to reporters in Los Angeles as follows. Let the sheriff handle the matter. He can appoint as many deputies as he wants. He has the power. I'm not going to call the guard to protect the kidnappers who willfully killed a fine boy like that. Let the law take its course. Well, the law did not take its course. A lynch mob was formed, broke its way into the jail, liberated the prisoners, and hung them. According to Wikipedia, child movie star Jackie Coogan, a friend of Brooke Hart from Santa Clara University, was reported to be one of the mob that prepared and held the rope for lynching. Although it's hard to imagine this now, according to Wikipedia, Governor Rolfe praised the action, stating that California had sent a message to future kidnappers and promised to pardon anyone involved in the lynching. At any rate, it was maybe more of a digression than we needed, but I do remember my grandfather telling me about this story and expressing the idea that there seemed no doubt about the guilt of the perpetrators. And as far as he was concerned, justice had been served. I would like to note that I had a chance to observe on Netflix recently a very well-done documentary concerning the 1966 Texas Tower Sniper. I was alerted to this program by Mr. McMillan, and I must say, it is well done. It chronicles a horrible episode where a deranged man climbed up a tower with an arsenal and started picking off bystanders. The crazy guy was one Charles Whitman, a Marine sharpshooter. And it was a pretty riveting tale of how three police officers and a citizen ascended the tower to take out the perpetrator, which, fortunately, they did. One of us noted, I won't say who, in a moment of black humor, that when the cops rounded the turn on the observation deck with their guns at the ready, they did not think to provide Mr. Whitman with his Miranda rights. They did not even order him to drop his weapon, they just blasted him. The sniper that murdered 18 people was shotgunned at point-blank range by one officer while the other emptied his service revolver into him. And, I'm certainly not going to say I disapproved. At any rate, let's see if we can work our way back to what started all this, an article about Stanton Delaplane. I certainly remember Mr. Delaplane's column in the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm doing some research, discovered that he was born in 1907 and died in 1988. He was a travel writer, and here's a part I just find irresistible. He is credited with introducing Irish coffee to the United States. Fellow columnist Herb Kane called Delaplane the last of the old irreplaceables. In 1944 and 45, Delaplane served as a war correspondent in the Pacific Theater of World War II. And, fast-forwarding to November of 1952, after drinking Irish coffee at Shannon Airport in Ireland, Delaplane convinced Jack Kopler, the then owner of the Buena Vista Cafe in San Francisco, to start serving it in his bar. Apparently on November 10th, 1952, the two spent hours perfecting the Irish method for floating the cream on top of the coffee. Beginning in 1953, Delaplane published his syndicated humorous travel column called Postcards. In later years, he would write his travel dispatches, which he called postcards, from his home on Telegraph Hill, finishing them over a martini and cigarettes by the piano at the Washington Square Bar and Grill, before sending them to the newspaper building by messenger. His writing style was characterized by very short sentences and sentence fragments, which he said was for the benefit of San Francisco Municipal Railway riders who had to read the paper while being jostled on the commuter train. It's noted that he was known for exaggerating and sometimes fictionalizing his stories and wrote often of the North Beach neighborhood and various eccentric people who lived in San Francisco. About his writing style, British commentator Alastair Cook wrote, "Stanton Delaplane wrote like a young and happy and wholly successful pupil of Hemingway, who rarely wrote sentences of more than 6 or 7 words and could go weeks without calling on an adjective. His peculiar magic, which I often probed into and never discovered, was to keep these bare sentences rollicking along in the most effortless way, running as clean as spring water over the bed of a brook. He could not help being an entertaining writer, and that is a gift that very few writers indeed can legitimately claim, from the double-dome philosophers to the lightweight journalists." Well, naturally, this piqued our interest to provide some examples of Mr. Delaplane's writing for you, dear listener. Here we have an example of Stanton Delaplane's postcard from Maui in 1971. "Early morning on the island of Maui. The Hawaiian sun and I are just getting up. A bunch of minor birds are chattering under the cocoa palms. The hibiscus are scarlet and gold belts. Plumeria trees are bustling with 1,000 ivory flowers. The ground below them is carpeted with fallen blossoms. The sea is mother of pearl set in silver. A few whipped cream clouds float in the morning sky. It's dry on this side of the island. People who find other parts of Hawaii somewhat humid are in heaven here. And heaven, for heaven's sake, is being developed." At any rate, let's pick up a different topic. In fact, let's make what we're pretty sure in the entire history of the world is the only occasion where a discussion has moved from the legendary San Francisco columnist Stanton Delaplane to the Tasmanian tiger. And we're hoping to bring on our Tasmanian, or in this case, Australian correspondent, Pamela Taylor, to talk about this. But Pamela was not up to speed on it. She needs to do a bit of research before she can discuss this. But according to New Scientist magazine, two tantalizing sightings have gotten some Australians excited about the possibility that this marsupial predator might still exist. Now, if you're keeping score, the world's largest marsupial predator lived all over Australia until about 4,000 years ago when they were pretty much wiped off the mainland, probably as a result of competition with the newly arrived dingo. They did persist on Tasmania, but the last known animal died in a zoo in Hobart in 1936. That was just 59 days after the Tasmanian government passed legal protection to halt an extinction for which it was largely responsible. For the previous 100 years, European settlers had subjected these animals to remorseless persecution. With a government bounty on offer, sheep farmers shot, trapped, and poisoned the animals in the thousands. But it is noted, sightings have continued across Australia. Almost all have been dismissed as hoaxes or cases of mistaken identity. Radio Parallax cannot verify whether Foster's Logger was involved in any of these sightings, but we strongly suspect that is possible. But according to the New Scientist piece by Bill Lawrence, one of those sightings was made by Brian Hobbs, who was a tourism operator and experienced bushman from Queensland. Back in 1983, while camping on the Cape York Peninsula, he twice saw a group of four dog-like animals with thick tails, short hair, and stripes on their sides. Hobbs kept it to himself for 34 years, but earlier this year, prompted by a report in his local radio station about the possibility of these animals being around, he contacted the station. And it turns out that apparently Mr. Lawrence is not the only one to have observed animals suspiciously resembling the Tasmanian tiger, or I thought they were called Tasmanian wolves. But evidently zoologists are planning to set up some camera traps in the region where they were last seen and see what happens. The people doing the searching admit it's a remote possibility, perhaps 1 or 2%. I don't know, we're kind of pulling for their success on this and are somewhat discomfited by the computer modeling done by Colin Carlson at the University of California at Berkeley, who used data on confirmed and unconfirmed sightings of the Tasmanian tiger to model the possibility that they're still around. And it doesn't look good. They came up with odds of 1 in a trillion. Anyway, we'll continue to follow the developments down under and see if they can't turn up evidence for a species long thought to be extinct. Hope springs eternal. And at this point, we shall turn from the world of animals to the world of plants. Again, relying upon that old standby New Scientist, their end-of-the-year issue generally puts together some pretty interesting pieces, and we have the one from December of 2016 about figs. According to author Mike Shanahan, a festive fruit, according to author Mike Shanahan, this festive fruit is still shaping our world. The piece notes that fig leaves clothed Adam and Eve, and the roots were used by the Maasai people to shuttle, and the roots were used by the Maasai people's god to shuttle the first cattle from heaven to earth. And according to an Indonesian story, two gods carved the first couple from their wood. The presence of fig trees in numerous origin myths is down to more than coincidence. Figs have shaped our world since before the dawn of humanity and have fed us and our imaginations for millennia. Now, as the world warms and forests fall, these extraordinary trees could help us to restore life to deforested landscapes. And it's all because fig trees cut a curious deal with tiny wasps back when dinosaurs still roamed. Thanks to this, they sustain far more biodiversity than any other tree. Today, there are more than 750 species of ficus, each of which relies on its own species of wasp to pollinate its flowers. In turn, the wasps can only breed inside the figs of their partner tree. Genetic studies suggest that this remarkable codependency is at least 80 million years old. Anyway, I'm not going to go through all the details, but suffice it to say that each fig depends on a wasp to go in, bring some pollen inside of the fruit, and in essence cross-fertilize it. The scientist notes that after these wasps depart, the fig's entire biology becomes geared toward attracting far bigger animals than fig wasps. The figs swell, blush, and are pumped with sugar. Birds, bats, monkeys, and other animals will come to feed on them, depending upon the species of will come to feed on them. Later, when the animals defecate, they will disperse tiny fig seeds far and wide, each with the potential to grow into a new tree. A side effect of depending on short-lived wasp pollinators is that ripe figs are found year-round across the tropics. They sustain wild animals when other fruits are scarce, feeding at least 1,270 bird mammal species, far more than any other fruit. This makes them ecological linchpins. Without them, many rainforest animals would struggle or starve. And now, notes the magazine, there are signs that planting fig trees could help us address deforestation, biodiversity loss, and climate change in countries as diverse as Australia, Costa Rica, Indonesia, South Africa, and Thailand. In Thailand, biologist Steve Elliott has been planting several ficus species in the degraded forests of Doi Suthaphoi National Park. He says figs are a magnet for seed dispersal. Wildlife comes flooding in. They grow fast, and their thick leaves cast a dense shadow that prevents weedy grasses from taking hold. Within 3 years of planting, several of the ficus species were producing figs, attracting monkeys, civets, and barking deer. Within 6 years, the number of bird species in the area rose from 30 to 87. Within 8 years, more than 70 other tree species had recolonized the experimental plots. In Costa Rica, researchers have been lopping 4-meter-long branches from fig trees and planting them as instant trees that sprout fresh roots and branches. It should be noted at this point that this correspondent, who has a fig tree in a corner of his yard but needs a fig tree in another corner of his yard, tried lopping off a 10-foot segment of tree and planting it in the ground. It ain't looking too good so far, but if I keep watering it, well, you'll be the first to know what happens. You may have noticed, too, even in the tropics, that that sometimes the roots of trees can crack rocks, and fig trees apparently are pretty good at this. A team in Thailand is now testing whether fig trees can help turn former open-cast mines back into rainforest by using their roots to split the bare rock into smaller pieces, letting air and water into soil. Said one researcher, if anything can break it open, it's going to be figs. And if I may digress slightly on this, why is it Americans don't eat figs? I mean, a perfectly ripe fig is about as good as it gets when it comes to fruit, fresh fruit. And yet, most people I know with fig trees in their backyard have a big mess under the tree where the figs fall onto the ground and rot or are scavenged by animals. If you go to Mediterranean countries, it's practically a staple. Anyway, if you've got a fig tree in the backyard and it's producing, gosh, pick them and eat them. Now, I admit, not all figs are created equal. Some of them are not as tasty as others. There's one I had recently called a tiger fig, sold in various markets, that was just unbelievably good. All right, we're using New Scientist pretty heavily in today's program, which we should. It's, I think, the best science magazine out there. Here's a little piece I noticed from the April 29th issue in the letters to the editor portion, which I think is probably worth quoting in its entirety. Referring to an earlier article in the magazine, a Gwen Humphreys from Yorkshire wrote the magazine to note, "You say that unlike the fossil fuel industry, drug firms haven't engaged in industrial-scale lobbying and the manufacturing of denial. But in the late 1960s and early 70s, this is exactly what happened to allow the continued addition of antibiotics to animal feed. This practice may have been far more damaging in breeding antibiotic resistance in pet. This practice may have been far more damaging in breeding antibiotic resistance in pathogens than human misuse of the drugs. In 1969, the UK government published the Swan Report, recommending restrictions, and there was a similar move at the US Food and Drug Administration. Leading researchers at that time supported this initiative. There was a major pushback from several government and political figures, with farming constituencies, however, and much scientific evidence was ignored. Use of antibiotics in animal feed continued for decades afterward. I suggest that industry lobbying and profit have been major drivers for the misuse of antibiotics for the past 5 decades and the crisis facing their use in human health today." We did not know that, and we are disgusted. It is obscene to misuse antibiotics, which are so important to treating human disease, for the sake of meat that's a couple pennies cheaper per pound. It's ridiculous. And several years ago, we talked in this program about efforts to domesticate foxes, which took place in the old Soviet Union. There's apparently a new book out titled How to Tame a Fox and Build a Dog, Visionary Scientists and a Siberian Tale of Jumpstarting Evolution. This is by Lee Allen Dugatin and Ludmilla Trut. In a book review from, what else, New Scientist? The following is noted. Nearly 60 years ago, Russian scientist Dmitry Belyaev began a remarkable experiment that still runs to this day. His aim was to selectively breed wild silver foxes to see if it was possible to bring about a similar transformation to the one that turned wolves into dogs. How to Tame a Fox, co-authored by U.S. biologist Lee Dugatin and Belyaev's long-term collaborator, Ludmilla Trut, is a charming account of this study, which has intrigued behavioral geneticists and evolutionary biologists for decades. Begun in secret at the tail end of Trofim Lysenko's devastating rule over Soviet genetics, Belyaev's study was expected to take a long time to produce significant results, if it ever did. Although foxes had been bred in captivity for their fur since the end of the 19th century, they remained as bitey and cross as they had been all those decades earlier. Under Belyaev's leadership, Trut and her co-workers used standardized tests to identify the least aggressive animals and then mated them together. Within 3 years, the foxes began to accept humans and breed slightly earlier in the year. After 4 years, one cub wagged its tail when Trut approached the cage. After 8 generations, curly tails appeared. A few years later, some foxes began to breed more than once a year. These findings were significant. In On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin wrote that in virtually every domesticated mammal species, certain characteristics often appeared alongside tameness, such as floppy ears, star-shaped forehead markings, multiple breeding periods, and reduced, often curly, tails. Belyaev became convinced that this revealed something about the genes involved in domestication. He put forward a rather vague notion that domestication involves a period of destabilizing selection, affecting the hormonal control of development. Well, whatever. Turns out we now have a lot more molecular genetic data about these animals, although it's still unclear what exactly is going on. At least that's the conclusion I draw from reading this. But the research group has identified recently, anyway, 335 genes that show differences in their activity in tame and the control foxes, some of which do affect hormone levels, but there's little evidence that these same genes were involved in wolf domestication. But here's the part I like at the punchline. After about 20 generations, tamed foxes became truly like dogs. We'd read about this. Loyal and unbearably cute. Here's what we did not know. It is now possible to adopt a tame fox. A substantial fee in that adoption goes towards supporting the research project. Reviewer Matthew Cobb, described as a zoologist at the University of Manchester in the UK, said after reading How to Tame a Fox, he was very tempted to go out and get one himself, but noted that his cats would probably object. That about does it for time. That was about as meandering a segment as I think we've ever done, but you know, what the hell. You've been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. This program was produced by Edward McMillan, and we'll see you next week.